dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most important battle spaces in that war, fortunately not yet of the kinetic kind, but very much a battle space nonetheless, is with communist China. And as we speak, the President of the United States is poised to sit down for what may be a very, very consequential summit meeting with Xi Jinping, the dictator for life, I call him, of communist China, who is with the president at the G20 meeting in Osaka, Japan. A man who has spent a very considerable portion of his distinguished career, particularly that in government, studying and working on the China portfolio, is our first guest. He is Joseph Bosco, an attorney by training, who served in the office of the Secretary of Defense for some 7 years in a variety of capacities, including as one of the country directors for China. He has gone on to do a number of things, including serving on the U.S.-China Task Force at the Center for the National Interest. He's been a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a senior fellow at the Institute for Korea-America Studies. Joe Bosco, it's good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Joe, you are a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and have participated in a recent program, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. But I did want to take stock with you of your expectations of this meeting between President Trump and Xi Jinping, the likelihood that, as some are anticipating, there will be a breakthrough on trade. And either way, what is the state of the U.S.-China relationship as you see it?
Well, the question is couldn't be more pertinent. I think we're clearly at an inflection point in U.S.-China relations, thanks to the policies of this administration. Others could have done many of the things that this president is doing. They chose not to for a variety of reasons. The reason we're at an inflection point is that the president has exerted his considerable powers in the trade area, as well as in the national security area, to indicate to China that the old game is no longer viable. That is, where China can violate the rules of the game in trade and security and freedom of the seas, and the U.S. will look the other way or indulge China, almost always because we told ourselves that we needed China to solve the North Korea issue. This gave the Chinese huge leverage over the U.S. in negotiations on all the other issues that were bedeviling us. So I think the president has gotten himself in a position where he has all the advantages going into the meeting with Xi. There, of course, are tremendous pressures from our business community as well as the academic community for him to now relent, show some flexibility, is how it would be called, and make concessions to China in exchange for their doing nominal or perhaps even more than nominal things in the trade area. I personally think that would be a mistake. I think the president should not forfeit the advantage he has. I think he should hew to the line, the strong line that he has taken on trade and on other issues. And I assume one of the things that they will discuss will be North Korea. And I'm hoping that the president will not be beguiled by Xi's so-called charm and believe that representations on helping with North Korea are a basis for the president backing off on some of his demands in the trade area.
Yeah, I want to come back to that at the end. Let me just ask you, interestingly enough, in your various previous incarnations, you were a law student at Harvard University studying under Henry Kissinger. And of course, Kissinger has both during his time as first the National Security Advisor to President Nixon and then as the Secretary of State under Gerald Ford, and ever since been a champion of a very different approach to the one you've just espoused, much more the sort of mainstream, shall we say, practice towards China, which I would characterize as, well, appeasement, basically, enabling the China buildup that we've seen now, both economic and increasingly military. This is a policy that President Trump has, as you say, departed from. The tipping point that you've discussed, Joe, would seem to me to be a choice between essentially taking full advantage of the opportunity for a fundamental course correction that has the chance of protecting this country against the present danger from China, and essentially squandering what may well be our last opportunity to make such a change. Do you see it that way?
I certainly do. I think that's a very apt way of describing the choices that the president faces. I mean, he's got a terrific national security team, I believe, at defense and state and NSC, and they're giving good advice. The president has his own instincts. He's the one who got it to the point where we're at now, his instincts. He talked as both a candidate and as president-elect of a no-nonsense approach to both China and North Korea. And he's demonstrated that with the help of this team that he can carry that out. On the other hand, he has been advised by people like Kissinger and many in the academic and think tank community not to be, quote, provocative, unquote, and unrelenting and inflexible in his dealings with China. After all, we must save China's face. We always hear this. They never worry about saving anyone else's face when they put us in a confrontational position. So I think Kissinger's, you mentioned him, I think his influence over Trump and his team has been significantly diminished. Although he still, to his credit, at his mid-90s, he still churns out op-ed pieces and makes public appearances and gives us the same, I would use the term accommodationist line that we ought to take with China. So I think that the president is wise to continue with the policy that he's put in place, and I think it is working. I agree with you. It would be a pity for him to squander the advantages he has built up. Of course, we've paid a price, I think a relatively small price in terms of the impact on our economy compared to what's happening with China. But we don't make those kinds of calculations when it's kinetic. We put people's lives on the line if the national interest is at stake. And I believe the national interest is at stake in our relationship with China now.
Couldn't agree more. It may be to Henry Kissinger's credit that he is pushing out this line still vigorously in a lot of different platforms. It's to the nation's detriment, though, I must say, and I hope that it will be ignored, as you say, by President Trump. One piece of the leverage that the president may have in this negotiation is one I want to talk to you when we come back after a short break, Joe Bosco, and that is the undermining of Xi's retaliatory tariffs against the United States in the agricultural sector as a result of a dangerous outbreak of both a virus and a pest that is now taking down China's agricultural sector. We'll be talking about that with Joseph Bosco and much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting with Joseph Bosco, a former distinguished senior official in the U.S. Defense Department, who had, among other things, responsibility for disaster relief and humanitarian affairs when he was working for the Secretary of Defense. He is a man I want to talk to about what seems to be an emerging disaster of epic proportions, one that may not be confined to communist China, where it is currently manifesting itself. Joe, a colleague of ours on the Committee on the Present Danger, China, Kyle Bass, co-authored a piece in the Daily Caller this week that is stunning in its dire forecast for the Chinese pig population and pork is a huge portion of the protein source for the Chinese. I'm told something like 70% is provided by pork. The population of the pork sector of the Chinese agricultural industry is now being literally more than decimated. It is being taken apart by something called the avian swine flu, a very highly communicable and deadly disease for which there is no vaccine or cure. I gather that in your previous incarnation in the office of the Secretary of Defense, you had to deal with this swine flu. Talk a little bit about what it means for an economy like China, well, for us, a society like China, for that matter, that it would be denied sources, domestic sources of this protein, and in particular, how it might play into Donald Trump's hand in negotiations with Xi Jinping at the summit.
Well, just to give you a little bit of the background, yes, we, in the humanitarian assistance shop, we did deal with pandemics in Asia, and both with swine flu, avian flu, AIDS, and two or three other pandemics. And in every case, we discovered that China had a critical role to play in terms of sharing information because of its experience with those diseases. But it refused to share, for the most part, refused to share that information. Taiwan, on the other hand, was a hero in terms of its cooperation. So we were very disillusioned with the approach China took. Now, in terms of this, I don't know how much they're sharing information on this particular outbreak. But as you say, it will have huge economic impact in China itself because the Chinese diet does depend heavily on the pork as a source of protein. In terms of its impact on trade issues, clearly it does not work to Xi's advantage to have this kind of an internal domestic blow. At the same time, he's trying to take a tough line with President Trump on the exchanges over trade.
Yeah, well, specifically, he has used as a retaliatory measure tariffs on, I believe, both meats imported to China from the United States and soybeans from agricultural states in this country that have in the past been part of Donald Trump's political base. There's actually, in addition to this horrible virus, another affliction China's cereal sector is now experiencing called the army worm. And according to Kyle Bass and his colleague, this is having an almost comparable destructive effect on wheat and corn and other things that the Chinese require for their diets as well. I guess one of the concerns here is first of all, that President Trump might feel under undue pressure to accommodate Xi because of what he is doing to the president's political base. That would seem to be about to be alleviated rather dramatically because the Chinese will have to import foodstuffs from this country, make no mistake about it. But also, Joe, that the disease, the pandemic, if you will, is unlikely to be confined to China. I'm told that the virus can live on for many months, if not years, in the blood of frozen pig carcasses. And if those are sold elsewhere, I was told yesterday that two shiploads of contaminated pork were stopped coming into an American port, I think, just this week. That virus could be inside our country in very short order with similarly devastating effects here, could it not?
Yeah, I don't know the science of this kind of disgusting scenario you outlined, but I guess the potential is there. But you raise an interesting point when you talk about the possibility that the president might have some sympathy for Xi's plight. There's an analogous situation, of course, and that was the treatment of the Hawaii, the CTD episode, where the president prevented that company from operating in the U.S., and Xi pleaded to the president that this was having a very adverse impact on the company in China and employment and all the rest, and the president relented and said, well, you know, he couldn't hurt his friend Xi that way. I would hope he would not demonstrate similar sympathy in this situation and to keep the U.S. national interest foremost.
Yeah. Well, there's another even more direct analogy that's got some of us quite concerned, and that is the possibility that he might do a similar thing for Huawei, which is, as you know, poised to really become a huge problem for us as it penetrates telecommunication systems worldwide with its 5G technology. And some of those, having served in the Defense Department, I'm sure you're very alive to this, some of those will be having a deleterious effect on the security relationship we have with some key allies, as a matter of fact. So it would be the height of folly to back away from the very strong line that the president has taken in executive orders and otherwise against Huawei, it seems to me.
I think that's absolutely right. I hope he would even reverse his position on the ZTE thing and get us back in the right posture there.
Better yet, you're absolutely right. Joe, let me turn to a topic that you addressed in a recent piece in The Hill, for which you write regularly. It was about Red China and its return. Tell us what you mean by that term and what that portends, if indeed you're right.
Frankly, I use the term Red China because Richard Nixon, as a candidate for president in 1967, wrote a piece in the an article in Foreign Affairs where he outlined his vision of where China ought to be in the future and what U.S.-China relations ought to be. And he referred to it as Red China in the beginning. He was well known as a strong anti-communist. But the point that I was making in that article was that Red China, when we use it in that pejorative context, has never gone away. The philosophy that Mao Zedong espoused with its animus toward the West, particularly the United States, has never really changed. The tactics have changed. The style has changed as the leaders have come and gone. But the fundamental philosophy of the Chinese Communist Party is that the United States and the West are their mortal enemy, that they cannot coexist peacefully together. And I think that's been submerged over the decades as we've gone through this policy of engagement. And Nixon himself said it later on as he looked back on what he had done and said, we may have created a Frankenstein, is the way he put it, meaning that we've enabled China to rise, so-called peacefully, but to build a huge economic and military capacity that they are directing against the West. So that we've gotten the economic reforms to a certain extent, but the political reforms, as we learned in Tiananmen Square, were not to be had under any communist system in China.
Yeah. Again, it needs to be mentioned that Richard Nixon made that mistake, and I think it was under the influence of your old mentor, Henry Kissinger. Let me turn to one last thing with you, Joe Busco. One of the other topics that you've addressed memorably at our Committee on the Present Danger China threat briefing a month or so ago was China's involvement with North Korea and the extent to which it has enabled the dynasty of the Kims to become an ever more dangerous force for us as well as for our interests and allies in Asia. Give us a flavor of how that's working out. We've recently saw the two men getting together, Kim Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un, in North Korea in the run-up to this summit meeting with the president. What did you make of that?
Well, you have to go back to there was a run-up to the original Singapore first summit meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, where after years of China taking the posture that the North Korea nuclear problem was our problem, the U.S. problem, not China's, and therefore we had to make whatever concessions were necessary to get North Korea to back off. After years of taking that posture, hands off, suddenly when President Trump is making progress with Kim, thanks to his maximum pressure campaign, suddenly Xi Jinping decides he needs to get back involved in this and summons Kim to Beijing for a sit-down over strategy with the United States. And, of course, we all noticed that immediately after that meeting, North Korea's attitude in the negotiation, in the talks, hardened and stiffened, and they started to use the old hostile rhetoric again. So I think Xi has seen that over the years, the North Korean situation has worked tremendously to China's strategic advantage. It has enabled them to posture as a responsible stakeholder, a good-faith negotiating a partner, a facilitator of talks and all the rest, meanwhile enjoying the status and prestige of that role and exerting leverage over the United States, as we said earlier, on trade and Taiwan and human rights, because we always told ourselves we need China and North Korea. Now with this visit, that she has made to Kim. I think he's sending a clear message to President Trump that the old allies, the old teeth and lips allies of the Korean War, are back together again, and the president is not going to be able to negotiate with Kim without Xi's involvement and his permission for any concessions that Kim might make.
And Xi, in fact, has no interest in actually having North Korea disarm or become otherwise aligned more closely with the United States. Joe Bosco, we have to leave it at that. There's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back for a much longer conversation very soon. In the meantime, thank you for your time today and your service to our country, going back quite some time and continuing today. Keep it up. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we will speak with Suzanne Schulte about North Korea, the China conversations this weekend, and much more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we have, as our next guest, a man I've come to admire tremendously for his leadership in the immigration public policy arena. He does that as the executive director of a truly indispensable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. He has been an active contributor to the public policy debate through his writings in various publications, including National Review Online, where he is a contributor. He is also the author of several books. The New Case Against Immigration, Both Legal and Illegal, and How Obama is Transforming America Through Immigration, a practice that continues apace under those who would succeed him as president. We have had a taste of what they would do, the various Democratic candidates for the presidential nomination of their party, over the past two nights. And so it's a special pleasure to invite back to our microphones Mark Krikorian. It's good to have you with us. Mark, thank you very much for joining us after what I gather was a late night watching the Democrats embrace open borders.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Tell us what you made of the various posturings that we were treated to both last night and the night before by some 20 would-be presidential candidates.
Well, if you confront the Democrats with the question, are you for open borders? They'll say, no, of course not. Of course we're not for open borders. But then when you ask, okay, what are your specific policies? They want to give free health care, taxpayer supported, to all illegal immigrants. They want to make sure that anybody who manages to get past the border can stay forever unless they are convicted of some particularly heinous crime. They don't want interior enforcement of immigration laws. They think that's illegitimate. Anyone who just says the words asylum or fear persecution, they say should simply be let into the country, essentially no questions asked. And if they're turned down in the end, they should not be removed. How is that all not open borders? I mean, that's just what it adds up to. I'm sorry, but if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a duck.
Mark, there's also actually some talk. It's the extreme leading edge of the Democratic, as I say, posturing on this at the moment, but it's almost certainly going to become the new test for, are you really sound on immigration from the perspective of the base? Namely, to stop criminalizing the illegal, you know, entry into this country, which would absolutely be, you know, the end of any kind of border to speak of. Do you anticipate that that is going to be the new benchmark for the Democrats? And that would, I assume you would agree, put to rest any question as to whether they have any desire to maintain our sovereign nation at all.
Oh, I mean, I think that's already happened. I mean, of the 20 people, was there maybe one on Wednesday night, I forget, who did not raise his hand in favor of ending any potential criminal penalties for infiltrating illegally across the border.
Got it. Well, it's even worse than I thought. And just, Mark, you've studied this closely. You've been analyzing it with your colleagues at the Center for Immigration Studies for years now. Just in the shortest of short forms, what happens to America if this prescription for open borders is actually adopted as policy?
Well, the Democrats will lose. So there's some hope in a sort of Trotskyite worse is better sense. I almost encourage them to embrace the most crazy and extreme immigration policies, because nothing's going to get Trump reelected faster than that. But, you know, there are Gallup just reported earlier this year, there are 42 million people just in Latin America who want to move to the United States. Now, they won't all do it, but the easier we make it, the less risky, the less problems that it entails, the bigger the share of them they're going to move here. And that doesn't count the Pakistanis and the Congolese and all the others who are now starting to get the message that you can just come in. So yeah, I mean, we're talking about, a complete disaster from a security perspective, from a labor market perspective, government welfare. None of that's sustainable. The problem is you're going to have a political reaction to stop it. And, we're seeing that in Europe now. And, you know, the bigger the problem that you're reacting against, the more intense the reaction is going to be. So how about we don't create the problem so we don't create an intense reaction against it?
Yeah. And Mark, when you talk about the security problem, this is generally poo-pooed by the open borders types. They insist that the people who are coming across are just trying to escape, you know, criminal gangs and terrible problems in their home countries and looking for a better life and will become, you know, gainfully employed, hardworking Americans in the very short future. Is it the case, based on, again, your serious study of this, that in the midst of many people who may fit that description are people who would do us harm as well?
Of course there are. I mean, how could there not be? Now, people on our side sometimes, you know, grab on to tentative reports and tend to exaggerate them. So you have to be careful and clear and fact-based in talking about this. But yes, of course there are. The Nicaraguan government just took into custody four people recently who are supposedly two Iraqis and two, I forget what the other ones were, who are supposedly affiliated with ISIS, who were headed north toward the border. Yeah, I think so, two Syrians. Well, that may be true. It may not. Maybe one of them is and the others aren't. I don't know. In other words, that's why we have intelligence agencies to examine these things. But this is not some fake thing. I mean, this is a real phenomenon. We've already had one terrorist who committed the terrorist attack in Canada. He's on trial now. He came across the border into the United States and then somehow or another just kept going and got into Canada. So this happens. This is not a fake thing. You can't exaggerate it. That's actually undermines our credibility, but it's a real thing.
Well, and one other factor in all of this is we don't know what we don't know. I mean, we're hearing on the basis of the numbers of people who are actually arrested, how many are coming across the border. But as you know, and you document so faithfully, Mark, there are some considerably larger number of people who get through without being arrested. And how many people in that sort of cadre may well be dangerous, terrorists or people bearing weapons of mass destruction or heavens knows what else is anybody's guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that when they do this, when they bring 100 people with kids and the Border Patrol has to focus on them, that means the rest of the border in that area isn't being patrolled. Who knows what's going across at that time?
Right. The kids piece of this is, of course, particularly vexing because there is unquestionably, as I understand it, human trafficking taking place in order to make sure that, you know, your caravan or your family unit, as it's called, has a family, at least a kid, whether it has any relationship to you or not. This, of course, was captured brilliantly in a photograph involving a small child and her father who were found face down, having drowned in the Rio Grande, trying to come across illegally. The kids are being subjected to unbelievable hardships, dangers, including, in some cases, sexual assault. Tell us about them and how they figure into this whole industry that is now bringing people here by the, well, hundreds of thousands now with impunity, it seems.
Well, the reason this is happening is that loopholes in our law make a kid, if you bring a kid with you, that kid basically is your passport to be released into the United States. And because of that, everybody knows, not just smugglers, but regular people, they know if you bring a kid, you're let go. So they go and bring a kid with them. Usually it's their own. Sometimes there, you know, there are renting kids, there are recycling kids. There's all kinds of appalling things that happen. But most of the time, people are bringing their own children. But there's that's still a form of child abuse. You're schlepping your kid through 1,000 or 2,000 miles of Mexico. And the problem here, you know, the Democratic candidate said this is all Trump's fault. He's an evil fascist, orange man, bad baby killer, etc. We are enticing these people to do this. In the law, there's a it's a magnet. In the law, there's a concept of an attractive nuisance. You're supposed to fence off your swimming pool, and if you don't, if some kid drowns, it's your fault. Well, that's what we're doing here with our immigration policy. We've created an attractive nuisance. We need to enforce the rules so that bringing a kid with you is not a golden ticket to be released into the United States.
Mark, this is such an important point, as you know, because really what's happening here is so corrosive to the rule of law in our country if we do otherwise. And we are doing a lot of otherwise at the moment, especially on interior enforcement, as well as some of what's going on at the border. Let me ask you lastly, Mark Krikorian, what do you make of the increasing chorus heard much in the Democratic debate over the past 2 days? We need comprehensive immigration reform. President Trump has put forward some ideas about what that would look like. Those don't seem to be the ideas that the Democrats have in mind. What's the history, quickly here, of comprehensive immigration reform in the Congress, and what do you anticipate would be its prospects?
When people use the term, it's a jargon term, comprehensive immigration reform, you need to put it in quotes. What that means is amnesty all the illegal immigrants who are here, and dramatically increase legal immigration in the future, basically like the Gang of Eight bill from 5 or 6 years ago, which would have doubled immigration after having amnestied all the illegal immigrants who were here. The president obviously is not for that. There are some things that he's been supporting I haven't been wild about, but the point is that overall approach, comprehensive approach, as it were, where you amnesty everybody, hugely increase legal immigration, and then kind of pretend you'll have some enforcement so you won't have more illegal aliens in the future. That's what the Democrats are about.
Mark Krikorian, thank you for all you do for our country and for our program. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll talk with Dr. Suzanne Schulte, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined, it's a delight to say, by a great friend and much admired colleague. Suzanne Schulte is her name. These days, she is the president of the Defense Forum Foundation and the chairman of the North Korean Freedom Coalition. But that only begins to scratch the surface of her service to particularly those who cherish freedom and who yearn to extend it to North Korea. She has been working extraordinarily capably and tenaciously at this for decades. And I'm very grateful that she has joined us to talk a bit about the latest on the eve of this important summit between President Trump and the patron, the enabler, one might say, of all of the horrors that the North Korean regime engages in against its own people and the threat that it poses to a lot of others, ourselves included, namely Xi Jinping. Dr. Schulte, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Frank.
Let's start with this conversation between the president and the man I call the dictator for life, Xi. Joseph Bosco, who we spoke to a moment ago, was impressing upon us, as he has done in connection with the work of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, that without China's active support, diplomatic, political, financial, trade, strategic, there would be no North Korean regime. Do you see it the same way?
I do. And I think that this is an issue that, Frank, you have focused so much attention on. It's so important about the refugees that are escaping. That this is a way that China relieves the pressure on that regime by forcing people back against their will that are trying to escape from North Korea. That's created a horrific situation. But in addition, you're absolutely right, Mr. Bosco, Joe Bosco is absolutely right. China could make all the difference in the world in creating pressure on this regime, and they continue to prop it up, to relieve the pressure that we're trying to put on it with the sanctions. I absolutely believe this chummy visit by these two dictators was prompted by the economic pressure that the sanctions have brought to bear on the Kim regime, because, you know, Xi Jinping wanted to visit North Korea for some time. Why all of a sudden now? I think it's because the regime is under incredible pressure. The sanctions are working effectively in bringing pressure on the Kim regime and the those in power that keep this dictatorship operating. And so I think that's one of the reasons that prompted the visit. Also, he wants to be the person that's calling the shots as far as North Korea is concerned. And I think that the chummy relationship supposedly that's developing between Trump and Kim Jong-un is also causing some consternation, you know, because of them exchanging so-called love letters back and forth. I have a different view on what that's all about, but absolutely, we see that they're relieving that pressure. I think that's what this was about. What they can do to relieve the stress that's happening with the economic sanctions.
And how can they undermine President Trump's efforts to bring North Korea to heel? So tell us a little bit about these love letters, Suzanne Schulte. What is your assessment of what President Trump is up to there?
I'm a big believer in acta non verba, action, not words. And I believe that Trump is the ultimate salesman. And I believe he's drawing this little boy dictator in, this murderous dictator in, that he has no illusions about what this dictator is capable of, but that this is a strategy they have. Because if you look at the exchange and the way that this is going back and forth, and it really makes me sick watching it, just because I've been involved with the people who have escaped from that place, and I know the horrors this man has committed against his own people.
And his father and his grandfather before him, of course.
And his father and grandfather, yep, the three-generation dictatorship. But I do think that what's happening here is, if we look at what the Trump administration is doing, and you brought up China, North Korea is a huge importer of coal, and we saw that there was a ship that was recently seized under our sanctions that we demanded. I believe it was in Indonesia that was seized. But anyway, there's a coal shipment that was seized. It's hugely significant because that's a huge cash cow for the dictatorship. But I think when we look at what the Trump administration is doing in the enhanced sanctions with creating pressure on this regime, that's the action that's most important, that he's pressuring he's putting on the ultimate pressure on Kim Jong-un. So I see him as basically setting him up. That's my personal view. I hope I'm right, because I know they're exchanging these love letters, but I'm not sure that I think Trump definitely has the upper hand.
Let me go back to something you talked about a moment ago. There's a gentleman by the name of Tomas Ojeda Quintana, who is the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in North Korea, who has very strongly urged China not to repatriate North Koreans who managed to get into China and away from this despotic, brutally repressive totalitarian regime in the North Korean. Let me ask you about two things. One, what would happen to those individuals should they be repatriated, Suzanne Schulte, based on a lot of hard experience here? And do you credit another report that I've seen that there are some 300 sites in the country, that is North Korea, that are dedicated for executions? And might these individuals, should they be returned, be subjected to that, perhaps among other horrors.
Right. Well, what happens if you are repatriated by China, forcefully sent back, which is what China's doing? They've decided to not treat these North Koreans that are trying to escape as refugees, but as economic migrants. This is how China treats them, rather than following their international treaty obligations. What they do when they send them back, they are put in a detention center in North Korea, and they're interviewed by the security forces in North Korea. If they find out they were trying to get to South Korea, they will be either executed or sent to a political prison camp, basically a quick death or a slow death. If they find out they maybe crossed the border just because they were trying to get a job, or maybe they were involved in some kind of trading with China business, they will be kept in that detention center and basically confined in that detention center for a period of months, up to a year or whatever. But the key thing here for what's happening right now, every single North Korean that's sent back will most definitely be tortured in these detention centers, and in some cases executed, every one of them, with no exceptions. But what's happening now, which is really of grave concern, is that most of these refugees that are escaping now will be subject to execution. And this is why it is the Chinese government and the North Korean regime and the Chinese regime have worked so hard to seal that border. That's why you have so many less people escaping. So who's escaping now? People that have connections to people in South Korea. And the family members, there's over 33,000 that have escaped. They're living, North Koreans have escaped. They're living in South Korea now. Most of them are trying to rescue their family members. So the only people that are crossing the border now are North Koreans that have access to cash that's coming from their family members. They're trying to rescue them. So that means that most of them are trying to get to South Korea, which means they are subjected to execution if they're sent back. It's a very tragic ongoing situation.
Yeah, and I fear that if we turn a blind eye to it, or the Chinese are allowed to get away with enabling this kind of horror with impunity, we are, well, complicit to some extent. Let me ask you about one other thing, Suzanne, while I've got you. There are two former prisoners of war that the North Koreans held for many years. They now reside in South Korea, as I understand it, very elderly fellows. But they're suing Kim Jong-un for damages based upon how they were mistreated. Tell us quickly about that.
I'm so glad you brought the POW issue. Yes, Han Jae-bak, who's 85, and Ro Sa-hong, who's 90, are suing for damages. They were held after the Korean War and spent basically most of their lives in North Korea, and they were forced to work in coal mines. This is such a significant development because many people don't realize, understandably, that there are still POWs that are from the Korean War that North Korea is holding.
South Korean POWs.
Exactly. There was over 82,000 POWs that were being held by North Korea. That includes Americans. They only returned 13,000 of those prisoners.
Suzanne Schulte, we are hard over time, but this is such important work that you are about at the North Korean Freedom Coalition, which you chair. Thank you to all of you for joining us as well. I hope you'll join us again Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.